Diane Ravitch, research professor of education and New York University historian of education, and from 91 to 93, assistant secretary of education and counselor to Secretary of Education Lamar Alexander in the administration of President George Herbert Walker Bush. We have a lot of education issues to talk about this hour. U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan is leaving his position in December. What will his legacy be? What do we know about John King, who is now number two in that department and who will take over as acting Secretary of Education? The president has called on states to cut back on standardized tests in schools, with no more than 2% of classroom time being spent on testing. Are we seeing a shift in the president's educational direction? Is enrollment down in teacher education programs? Diane Ravitch says we need leadership that believes in the joy of learning and in equality of educational opportunity, and we haven't had either for 15 years. She's the author of many books, including The Death and Life of the Great American School System and How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. Whenever we have her on, we get a lot of phone calls. So let me give you our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Diane Ravitch, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
Hi,
Kathleen.
Great to be with you. Yeah, nice to have you here. Well, let's start with this rather unusual news, I thought, from the president over the weekend, calling on states to cut back on standardized tests in schools, no more than 2% of classroom time being spent on testing. Where did that come from this administration?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, there is this huge backlash among parents against the amount of time devoted to testing. And also, just the testing itself has become the whole means and ends of education. So that in New York State, we had 220,000 kids refuse the test.
This Did you obvious. Really? Wow.
Yeah, that's 20% of all the kids, and they're it's historic. And so we're seeing this kind of opting out, as it's called, happening across the country. And it's I think he was trying to stop the momentum of the opt-out movement by saying, look, we're going to limit tests to only 2%. But various people have done the math and said, what 2% is what we already have. Actually, right now we're at 2.34%. So they're just cutting off a third of a percentage point at best. And what it boils down to, depending on how many, most kids go for 180 days a year and have 6 hours a day of classroom instruction. And it turns out that 2% of that is about anywhere from 18 to 24 hours in a year. For a third grader, that's a lot of time, a lot of standardized testing. The problem is the Common Core testing in particular takes anywhere up from 8 to 11 hours. If you can imagine an 8-year-old sitting for an 8-hour test, they might as well be taking the law school exams or the SATs.
Right.
So the saying we're going to cap them at 2%, he actually got that idea from John King, who's the next Secretary of Education, because he enacted that, he brought about that rule in New York State, and of course it didn't reduce the level of testing at all, because it doesn't take into account how much time is devoted to test prep, and the weeks and weeks and weeks that are devoted to getting ready for the test, because the test has become so crucial. So in a way, it's kind of, as one of the researchers said in a blog last night, this is smoke and mirrors.
You brought up the name of John King. As long as you did, let's get a preview of what we can expect from him. Randy Weingarten from the American Federation of Teachers said nobody doubts his commitment to children, but his tenure as New York State's education commissioner created so much polarization in the state with parents and educators alike that even Governor Cuomo is finally doing a mea culpa over the obsession with testing.
Right. Well, what John King essentially did was to cause the opt-out movement. No, there was no single figure who did more to promote the opt-out movement, not meaning to, than John King, because he absolutely doesn't listen to parents. He had called parents a special interest group, and whenever he would go to parent meetings, he would be hissed and booed and would just walk out. But his own kids were in a private school, so he didn't subject them to what he was subjecting the rest of the state's children to. He has been devoted to Common Core. He wanted to be first out of the gate to implement it, first out of the gate to test it, and the results of testing in New York State have been catastrophic for many children, particularly children with disabilities and English language learners and minorities.
Mm-hmm. Common Core is really hard, I understand. Those tests are really hard.
What happened with the test was that the people who designed the test made the decision, for reasons I can't understand, that the passing mark would be raised so high that they knew that a majority of kids would fail. And they have on their websites, there are two consortia that test Common Core. One is called, and I'll just give you the acronym because mm-hmm. I don't remember what it stands for. One is called PARCC, P-A-R-C-C, and the other is called Smarter Balance. But they both decided that the test would be so hard that about 60 to 70% of kids would fail it. They set the standard in alignment with what's called proficient on the National Assessment of Educational Progress. That's the federal test, and the scores were just released overnight. On NAEP proficient, most kids don't reach proficient. There's only one state in the country where even 50% of the kids have ever reached NAEP proficient. That's Massachusetts. So when you say from the get-go, as John King predicted before the tests were given, that 70% of the kids would fail, and in fact 70% of the kids fail, including 97% of the English language learners, 95% of the kids with disabilities, and more than 80% of black and Hispanic kids. So there's something, I don't know, I think it's almost like child abuse to create a test where you know that most kids are going to fail. If those tests are used either for grade promotion or for high school graduation, we're going to have a huge problem in this country, which is what if no one ever gets out of third grade? Third grade will become a parking lot because most kids in third grade will not pass these tests because the passing level is set so high.
Well, those who support it, Diane, say, well, we should be able to pass those tests. Schools are too easy.
Well, that's not really true. They're working on the assumption that if you keep raising the bar, somehow kids will get smarter and smarter, they'll work harder, they'll study harder. And this is like saying to an athlete, well, you couldn't jump over the 4-foot bar, let's raise it to 6 feet. How about if we raise it to 7 feet? You keep raising the bar, that doesn't change the athlete's ability to jump over it. Kids need support, they need smaller class size, they need many things. But even with all of those things, you're still never going to get 100% of the kids meeting what I consider to be a standard that amounts to an A. And no, even in any school, no matter how great the school is, some kids will get B, some kids will get C, some kids won't pass at all. Mm-hmm. But you don't set the standards so high that most of the kids will fail. If a teacher did that, the teacher would be called in and asked, why are you testing the kids at a level that's two grades above their ability?
You have written, when President Obama was elected, many educators and parents, I'm sure you are among them, thought that he would bring a new vision of the federal role in education. What vision did you hope he would bring, and what did he give us?
Well, his advisor in 2008 was Linda Darling Hammond, who's a professor at Stanford, and she's very well respected in the education profession. She's very knowledgeable, and she was a spokesperson for the candidate, Barack Obama. But then after the election, he dropped her and picked Arne Duncan, who led what is a very, very low-performing school district, and he talked about the dramatic increase in test scores, which turned out not to be real. There was no dramatic increase in test scores, but Arne Duncan brought the agenda he had in Chicago, which was closing schools, opening new schools, and relying on test scores for his decisions. The agenda that the federal government should have is, first of all, it's the role of the federal government to collect data. That's its essential mission, and to do good research, to sponsor good research. Secondly, to protect the civil rights of specific groups of children who have been discriminated against in the past. Third, to support the education of children with disabilities. And the secretary himself should be a person with the bully pulpit who can encourage and promote education. It is actually in the law that no federal official is permitted to interfere or even to attempt to influence curriculum or instruction. And this particular secretary, Secretary Duncan, has continually interfered with curriculum and instruction. And just the fact that they are creating federal tests or federally paid for tests, and then saying, well, we're going to tell every district to limit testing time. This is not the role of the federal government. These are state decisions.
You have, in your criticism of him, talked about his tenure being marked by the rise of an aggressive privatization movement. How, did he, as Secretary of Education, is he directly involved in that growing movement?
Oh, definitely. I mean, for a long time, he mostly visited charter schools, and he has not interfered anywhere where vouchers were under consideration. No, he's never gone to, he's never gone to a state like Wisconsin and said, we urge you not to adopt vouchers. This is a violation of church and state, and vouchers don't get better results anyway. He should have been a strong, clear voice against vouchers, but neither Secretary Duncan nor, for that matter, the president have really taken a proactive role in supporting public education. They have both been cheerleaders for charters, and very often, whether it's in the State of the Union or in Duncan's school visits, they tout the virtues of privately managed charters, and they don't speak out against the enormous abuses that we have seen in charter schools across the country. Particularly in states like Ohio, Michigan, Florida, Arizona, financial abuses, political abuses, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So essentially you say that his vision was no different than the vision of George W. Bush, Republican administration, Democratic administration. Why would their visions be so similar when it comes to public education?
Well, you know, the Race to the Top, which is the signature program of the Obama administration, is really not different from No Child Left Behind. It's you might say, and at one point President Obama actually said No Child Left Behind was the foundation for No Child Left Behind, and he was absolutely right. It was the foundation for Race to the Top. Race to the Top is actually worse than No Child Left Behind in that No Child Left Behind targeted schools and said that schools would be closed if they couldn't raise test scores. And Race to the Top targeted teachers and principals and said that if they couldn't raise test scores, the schools would be closed and the principals would always be fired and either all or half the staff would be fired. These are very punitive approaches to education. Education is a process that involves many, many actors, parents, students, teachers, administrators. And to just go in and say, your scores are low, I'm closing your schools, well, big surprise, I would say 80% or more of the schools that have been closed are in poor and minority communities. The scores are low not because the teachers are bad, but because the kids are growing up usually in awful conditions.
I'm wondering about, and this is not just in Wisconsin, as you know, there have been so many states that have taken on the collective bargaining, teachers' ability to collectively bargain, due process for teachers. Do you have a feel, and has anybody done studies, Diane, as to whether or not people are forsaking the teaching profession now, what the morale is among teachers in many states in this country?
Well, there have been annual surveys of morale, and they show teacher morale plummeting, especially since 2009, because virtually everyone's aware of the kind of public criticism of teachers, which is that they're responsible for low test scores, and the assumption is that only bad teachers work in poor communities, and while the teachers working in affluent communities are wonderful teachers because they get high test scores. What everyone, I think, who studied education for any length of time understands is that there is a very tight correlation between family income and test scores. In fact, some people have said that the SAT scores, and for that matter, every standardized test, is a family wealth index. Hmm. Those who have the most, their children have the highest scores, and those who have the least, their children have the lowest scores. And it's you can tell me your family income, and I'll tell you your child's likely test scores. But you asked me before a question that I didn't fully answer, which is that why have the two parties converged?
Mm-hmm.
This is a lot of people find this very puzzling, because the Democrats used to have an approach in which the most important thing was equity, meaning equitable funding for all schools, and federal money flowed primarily to aid the districts and the schools that had the poorest children. So equity was a big thing, meaning equitable resources. Teacher preparation was another big thing for the Democratic Party. and equality of educational opportunity. That was the Democratic platform. The Republican education agenda has been consistent for at least 50 years, and that is testing, accountability, and choice. And so now we find that the Democratic agenda has become testing, accountability, and choice. And I have written in various places who lost the Democratic agenda. And I do think that the Obama administration has to take responsibility for that, because they have fully embraced testing, accountability, and school choice as the answer to our education problems. And to me, this is manifestly untrue. You can I can give you tons of research that shows it's not true, but the most important thing that we could do to improve test scores would be to reduce poverty. And if you look at the scores that were just released overnight by the federal government, there was a nationwide flattening and decline of scores. We haven't seen this since 1990. So there's something wrong with the agenda that they're pursuing, which is to... which is very punitive, and that is if you don't get higher scores, your school may be closed, your job, you may lose your job. That doesn't work. I mean, teachers are not mules. They're not donkeys. They don't need to be threatened with their job, and the principal shouldn't be threatened with their job. The schools work best when there's teamwork and an atmosphere of collaboration. But what has changed, I think, the agenda nationally has been the influence of money. You need a lot of money to run a campaign, and there a group was formed called Democrats for Education Reform, and they are hedge fund managers and billionaires who are interested in privatizing the schools because, first of all, they don't believe in public education. They do believe in charters, and the group DEFR, Democrats for Education Reform, was extremely important in the last two national campaigns, in raising a lot of money for the Democratic candidate and encouraging Barack Obama to have the same position that they have. I learned that in 2005, when they started this group, the new Senator Barack Obama from Illinois was their first speaker. So they have made a big push to try to persuade, especially the minority community, that vouchers and charters are for the benefit of black and Hispanic kids. And it's simply not true, and Milwaukee is the best illustration of that. Milwaukee is now has more choices than any district in the country, and it has a vigorous charter sector and many children going to voucher schools.
Yes.
And the outcome for the children in all three sectors is poor. I mean, Wisconsin, I was just looking at the NAEP results overnight. Wisconsin has the biggest black-white achievement gap of any state in the country, including the Deep South.
Yes.
So black students have not benefited from all of this choice, and most of them are in the state or in Milwaukee. And the whole thing has been a terrible sham.
So hedge funds then became more important in terms of raising money and support than teachers' unions?
Oh, yes. They can raise much more money than teachers' unions. And when you add together the Walton family, which pours billions and not billions, They put up about $200 million a year for their education program, which is charters and vouchers. But the members of the Walton family individually give a lot to politics, and each of them is a billionaire. So you have quite a lot of I guess there's like, I called it the Billionaire Boys Club. And the Billionaire's Boys Club is, at one level, it's the philanthropists like Bill Gates, Eli Broad of California, the Walton family of Arkansas. But then you have the individual billionaires who are pumping a lot of money into privatization. And for some reason, there's an overlap with this shadowy right-wing group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, whose members are legislators from all over the country and which is funded by the nation's biggest corporations. So it seems like there's a pincers move from both the right and also whatever you call the Democratic Party leadership today, to privatize public education, first in the cities, but then pushing out into the suburbs.
Diane Ravitch is our guest this hour. We asked her to talk about Arne Duncan and what his tenure as Secretary of Education was like and what we can expect from the person who will succeed him. And we are talking as well about the president calling on states to cut back on standardized tests. That came over the weekend. And the news that just was on NPR just a few moments ago, that math and reading scores in this country are down, and why that can be the case when there's been so much emphasis on testing. We also want to branch in. I want to talk about the number of people who are going into teacher education programs in this country, and because of all that's happened, if the numbers have declined, thus begging the question, who will teach our children? Why is it that Democratic administration, the Obama administration, similar to the Bush administration when it comes to support or lack of support for public education in America? Here's our phone number. Join us. What do you think? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Diane is research professor of education at New York University and historian of education. She was assistant secretary of education in the administration of President George Herbert Walker Bush. She's the author of many books, including The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. If you're affiliated, well, we all are affiliated with education in some way. Do you think there has been an exorbitant amount of testing? What do you think of the movement in this country by Democrats and Republicans to privatize schools? What about segregation of schools? If you remember a show we did a few weeks ago on that, it was a very, very important show, and something we don't hear very much about is that one of the reasons our schools are so segregated, that we have this huge gap between minority communities and not minority communities, although the minority will soon become the majority when it comes to test scores. What do you think of the reign of Arne Duncan? What do you think of Mr. King, who will be taking over? What do you think about going into teaching? We'd love to hear from you. Lines are open for you right now. We'll start calls in a moment with Diane Ravitch on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Diane Ravitch, this hour, phones are wild right now, so just keep listening and you can get through. 800-486-8655. Gretchen is calling in first, Diane, from Minneapolis. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi, I'm actually traveling to Milwaukee. I was a teacher in the Wisconsin for 20 years, just a little north of Milwaukee. I'm retired. I have a sister who currently teaches 8th grade science in one of the schools in western suburbs. Her students are, I would say, middle class, or what used to be middle class. And here's the conversation that she and I had this summer. She has been frustrated because she has a directive from her district, and it came through last year, that she may not do any assessment that has any kind of objective component. All of her assessment must be on higher level thinking skills. That would be analysis, summary, predicting. There can be nothing that tests basic comprehension, knowledge of, for example, in science, of how variables work. That is all assumed to be in the control of the students. And so her frustration, of course, as any normal thinking person can understand, she can have 30 students in a class. Well, it's pretty easy to predict that not all of them have the basics under control. So I'm asking your guest, does she see that the emphasis on higher level thinking, which theoretically is good, but that it assumes that the more basic skills are controlled? And then what happens when, and that's a directive on the district level?
Diane.
Well, you know, a lot, this all comes from the Common Core, and the Common Core was written by people who were not classroom teachers. It did not have anyone on the writing committee who had any experience with early childhood education. It had no one with experience teaching children with disabilities. And so it's a somewhat idealistic set of standards that assumes that if everybody is told to work harder, do more, have higher expectations, pitch the activities and whatever, the reading levels way above where the kids are, that somehow that's going to raise achievement. And that's why there's a national backlash against the Common Core, because it's very unrealistic to think that all children are going to be able to do the same thing just because they're the same age. And teachers understand that kids are very different and that you have to tailor the instruction to where the kids are. You can't pitch it to grade levels above where they are. And in most places where the Common Core was adopted, it was not, there was not enough preparation. They didn't have the materials. They didn't have the teacher training. And so it's created a lot of disruption and chaos. And that, I think, is really bad for kids and very hard for teachers, which is why there's so much demoralization among teachers today.
Thanks, Gretchen, for the call. Fawn in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thanks, Kathleen. I want to say that because I'm from Chicago, I somewhat peripherally observe what's going on there. And I just like to observe that under Rahm Emanuel, who's coming straight out of the Obama administration, a huge travesty has been committed in Chicago. He just took the Chicago public schools and systematically closed many of the schools in black and brown poor neighborhoods while preserving schools and school educational quality in the wealthier white neighborhoods. Majority white neighborhoods. And this is in the face of huge outcry from the public, including many of the parents in those affected neighborhoods. And I'd like to point out that it's not as though there's no connection between this systematic segregation and degradation of schools for black and brown and especially poor children, and on the other hand, some of these salient issues that we've seen rising to the fore nationally, such as police brutality, especially towards black and brown and poor citizens, and also at the outcomes of mass incarceration disproportionately affecting black and brown and poor citizens. How can you disenfranchise children in the classroom and basically nullify their hopes of and chances of succeeding in the wider world and not also vilify them in the eyes of the public and the police forces, whether deliberately or not, and also of the legal system. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Fawn, for your comments. Diane?
Well, yeah, I think there's a connection, and I think that Rahm Emanuel and Chicago were really good examples of where the interest of African-American and Hispanic communities have been not only ignored but abused. There was just recently a hunger strike that went on for 30-some-odd days in front of Diet High School because the local community wanted that high school not to be turned into charters, not to be privatized, but to remain a comprehensive school serving the neighborhood. And because of these 12 hunger strikers, the mayor eventually did give in. Rahm Emanuel will go down in the history of American education is the only mayor ever to close 50 public schools in a single day. I mean, that was absolutely outrageous, and almost all of these were schools in poor minority communities. And they will be replaced by charter schools over which the community has no control because they have private boards that control them. So many people think this has to do with gentrification. Because there are black and brown communities that are in the center city that are being gentrified. And by closing the schools and shipping the kids out of there, it's easier to gentrify them. It is a disgrace. And, obviously I'm very much opposed to this idea that kids should be treated with indifference to the views of their own community.
Could we talk a little bit about integration of schools? We did a show a few months ago, Diane, with a woman from the New York Times who did that remarkable series with ProPublica and stated that the only thing that leveled achievement between minority communities and not minority communities was integration, and cited a very specific period of time where schools were more integrated than they ever had been. And counting for every other variable, that was the one that helped more students succeed than others. It really seems to just be something that's not even discussed anymore. Should it be?
Oh, absolutely. There have been studies done by an economist at University of California, Berkeley. His name is Rucker Johnson. And he studied longitudinal studies of black men and women who had been in desegregated schools. And he found that as compared to those who were in segregated schools, that those who had experienced desegregated schools had were more likely to graduate high school, more likely to go to college, more likely to graduate from college, more likely to have higher lifetime earnings, have a healthier life, and also to pass these advantages on to their children. And he attributed this to the fact that they had access to more resources because of being in desegregated schools, and also were treated differently. You know, the truth is that segregated schools are usually treated very unequally. They're not equitably resourced, and there's a different disciplinary policy applied to black children and brown children than to white children. And there, the charter school movement has intensified segregation. The source of many of the studies of the negative impact of charters on segregation is UCLA Civil Rights Project. Gary Orfield at UCLA has been studying school segregation integration for many years, and he put out a report a year or two ago saying that charters exacerbate segregation. So one of my dreams, and I mentioned this in a post this morning, was about what if Arne Duncan had taken the $5 billion he was given by Congress and given with a free hand, saying, do something to reform schools. And he came up with all this more No Child Left Behind, more testing, make teachers' evaluations and their income depend on test scores. What if he had instead had a competition and said to states, you can win hundreds of millions of dollars if you come up with real practical plans to desegregate your schools?
Wouldn't that be
interesting? To the greatest extent possible. 5 years later, we would have dramatic change in our society. But instead, we have the sense that $5 billion just went down the rat hole to testing companies, to outsourcing of activities and tech companies. And, you know, everybody now has to take their test online, so that's a whole new honeypot for corporations. And nothing has changed except that teachers are demoralized. So I feel that the $5 billion could have been far better used had it been used to promote a genuinely important social policy goal, which is integrating our
yes.
schools. You can't integrate the schools without encouraging either rezoning or changing the housing patterns.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Fawn, so much for your call. Kate in Duluth, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate Wisconsin Public Radio so much, even though I live in Minnesota. I'm a supporter. The reason that I called is I'm no longer a teacher, but I was a speech therapist for many years in our school system. I live in Duluth, Minnesota. And I remember the first charter that people worked to get started here. And it was in the 80s, and it was progressive. People who you might call having progressive politics who were behind starting it. I didn't understand it at the time why they felt that this was going to be the answer for, improved education and improved children's lives. In the 90s in our system, we received some grants to set up some special focus elementaries in the what we might be called inner city. And one of them was a language-based school, which was very successful until, as the 90s went, money was cut. And so the last speaker's comment about this money, as I've worked in the schools, I've seen more and more where there's a greater workload on teachers and discouragement from there. The other thing I wanted to bring up, though, is that this privatization of education is only part of a much wider movement in the United States of privatizing many types of services.
Diane.
Well, this is absolutely right. You can put in the word privatization and put in almost any adjective, like public libraries. Even police and firefighters, there's hardly any public service where there's not an effort being made to privatize it. What happens with privatization of public services is that the haves get more advantages than the have-nots. Private organizations are not terribly interested in equity. They're interested in making a profit. That's why they're private. And, you know, I don't criticize them for wanting to make a profit, but I wish they'd stay out of the public sector because that's the way it works. I mean, there have been many studies showing that when the hospitals are privatized, they tend to avoid the people with the most serious conditions. They try to find someplace else to send them. When jails are privatized, the people who run the jails are happy to see the incarceration rates going up because that's more money for them. So, you know, you get all these metrics about how to make more money, but what you're not getting is equity in the distribution of public services. And I do think that the movement to privatize public schools is a large part of that. And I wanted to mention also in terms of why the charter schools went wrong. I was there at the beginning when the charter movement began, and it sounded like a really good idea at the time. And I supported the idea because initially charter schools were going to enroll the kids that had the highest needs. The idea was they would have two functions. One would be to enroll kids who were dropouts, to enroll kids who were about to drop out, and to bring them back and share the ideas of how it worked with the public schools. They were never intended to be a union-busting mechanism, which they have become. The other thing about charters was that they were going to be innovative and point the way to brilliant new ways to educate kids. Right. Well, neither of these things happen. They no longer, with very few exceptions, they no longer reach out to the neediest kids because of No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top. They want the highest test scores so that they can boast that they're better than public schools. And that's what's happening in city after city and state after state. The charter schools are incentivized to avoid the very kids with the greatest needs. And so they have been criticized repeatedly for excluding kids with disabilities, excluding kids who are English language learners, taking the kids only with the mildest disabilities so that they can boast that they cured them. And the other thing that's happened is that the for-profit sector has moved into the charter business. And so I now refer to the charter sector as the charter industry because there are many for-profit organizations that have extracted millions of dollars of taxpayer funds for their investors. And so you have, for example, Turner Capital creating a fund of $1 billion. And Turner Capital is working with Andre Agassi, the tennis star, who's a high school dropout, because they want to open charter schools because this is a good real estate investment. You have chains like Mosaica, which took over a district in Michigan and pulled out after a year because they found they couldn't make a profit. And Charter Schools USA, I mean, there are for-profits all over the state of Michigan. There are profits for-profit corporations in Ohio. I mean, we shouldn't have for-profit public schools. This makes no sense. We shouldn't have public funds flowing to for-profit corporations for a basic public service. But the charter sector has become corrupted by greed.
Diane Ravitch is our guest this hour. Thank you very much, Kate, for your call. And we're talking about Arnie Duncan's legacy. We're talking about the charter movement. We're looking at desegregation of schools, or segregation of schools, better way to put it. The new person who will take over as Secretary of Education, why it is that the Democrats and the Republicans seem to be on the same page with less than enthusiastic support for public education. Diane has been in this field for a long time. She's a research professor of education at New York University and a historian of education. She was Assistant Secretary of Education in the administration of President George Herbert Walker Bush. She is the author of a number of books, Reign of Error, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. And we are going to welcome more phone calls in just a minute here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Diane Ravitch, Brian in Eau Claire. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, how are you?
Good. Hey, I just wanted to say that it sounds like there's a lot of variables here to student success in the classroom. And that's really what this comes down to. This is about the kids. And that's because life's complicated for people. It's messy. And I think what I keep hearing from my friends who are teachers and from your guests is how much, finance is playing to the equation here. and also just how that kids need supportive teachers, kids need supportive families, and if you have supportive teachers and supportive families, then there's a formula for success there. And I just think it really comes down to people. There's a lot of focus on testing, and there's a lot of variables that can affect the test score. But, I mean, the only thing that can really affect a child's life, and the thing that my teacher friends get most passionate about, is that people affect people. And if we invest appropriately in people and in teachers, the number one thing teachers are most passionate about is the kids. And so if we can help them become just more passionate about making a difference in the student's life, and also take into consideration that life is complicated, not be so heavily focused on the testing, mm-hmm. I think it would be very successful in the long run. So
thank you, Brian. Thanks for the call. Diane?
Well, I agree. One of the mistakes that have been made over the past 15 years is to assume that the teacher is somehow working with a group of empty pots in front of her and that she can fill up each head with X amount of knowledge, and if she doesn't, then the teacher should be fired. But as your caller said, there are many influences on children, and social scientists would say most of the influences on children don't even take place in school. They happen in home. They have to do with parenting, with home life, with motivation, with a million things that the teacher can't control. About a year ago, the American Statistical Association put out a very brief statement, just 8 pages, saying that test scores should not be used to judge teachers because teachers only affect between 1 and 14% of the changes in test scores. And the rest of the what would account for all those changes come from the home, the community, and other kinds of things that the teachers have nothing to do with.
What's happening with interest in the teaching profession, Diane?
Well, people are generally afraid to go into teaching these days. There has been, in state after state, a dramatic decline in the number of people entering the profession. In California, where you have to have a 4-year liberal arts degree before you can become take a teacher education program, there's been something like a 50% drop in the number of people applying to enter teaching programs. And there's a teacher shortage that's now being reported really almost all over the country, in the Midwest, and many other places in the far West. And it's because experienced teachers are leaving. There are state legislatures that are treating teachers very shabbily. Everyone seems to have been influenced by this idea that emanates from Washington, D.C., that we have to take an approach that's very hard-nosed towards teachers, that they need to be driven, they need to be punished, they need to be threatened. And if they don't have an axe over their head, they won't get the test scores. And if they're kept in a state of constant fear that they might lose their job, they'll be better teachers. Well, this is crazy. You might say it's crazy talk. But that's been federal policy now since 2002. And it's intensified under Race to the Top, and teachers have gotten the message. They've gotten it from movies like Waiting for Superman, that put out this phony message that teachers are lazy, they're greedy, they're only interested in themselves. Then you get an organization like Michelle Rhee's Students First, that makes the claim that somehow students and teachers are at odds with one another, and she's on the side of students, but the teachers are bad people. And if you just fire enough of them every year, you end up with good teachers. All of this negativity in the media and coming from the government has had an impact on the teaching profession. And so many states have enacted legislation that allows people to become teachers with only a few weeks of training. That, too, undermines the teaching profession.
I'm sure
Teach for America undermines the teaching profession.
Yeah. Thanks, Brian, very much for the call. Jim in Rice Lake, hi.
Hi. My daughter is a 20-year teacher, and I'm a diehard Republican, so you can imagine what our discussions are about. But I recently read a book that she suggested I read, written by Dr. Dufour, that talks about the success of the school systems in Finland. Why aren't we applying some of those principles to our educational experiences here?
Well, you ask a good question, and I've been to Finland and visited their schools, and the secret of their success is that no one gets to teach until they've had 5 years of preparation. And teaching is a very well-paid profession. Everyone who teaches, or everyone who's a principal, is unionized. They all belong to the same union. And they are respected. They are as respected as doctors and lawyers and any other profession. It's very hard to become a teacher in Finland. They only accept 10% of those who apply to the teaching colleges. There are only 8 teaching colleges where they have the same program, and the teachers come through that, and they're very well prepared. There are no standardized tests in Finland at all. The teachers write their own assessments. They have a lot of autonomy over what they teach and how they teach, although there's a national curriculum. It's just a very broad guideline. It doesn't tell anyone how to teach or in what order. But the teachers are, if you ask Finnish people, they'll say the teachers are key. They put tremendous emphasis on the arts, also on physical education. And I've seen districts, entire districts in this country, that have eliminated physical education or have it down to only once a week. In Finland, the children have a recess after every class. They have a 15-minute opportunity to go out into the schoolyard and have unstructured play.
Huh.
So they put the emphasis on children, on having them grow up free of the pressure of testing, and having, you know, putting the emphasis on the arts and on joy of performance.
Maybe we all need unstructured play and everybody would be a little better off, right? Thanks so much.
When I hang up, I'm going to go outside and run around.
Okay, I'll do the same. Clara in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello.
Hello, Clara.
Oh, I'm very pleased to hear you speak of the travesty in Milwaukee. As a teacher from kindergarten all the way through college and a retired professor at this point in time, I have one question that I've been asking for a long, long time. What has happened to these children in Milwaukee, I'm speaking of, who were in these choice schools, the charter schools, that were closed? Where did those children go? Nobody seems to know. If they didn't go back to the public school, there's no record of where those children went or are going. And this has been very troublesome to me. As a retired professor, I can speak of the kind of acrimony that exists within universities and colleges toward teacher education programs where expectations are viewed as too high. And so I'm very pleased to hear you speak of the charter movement and the choice movement, because both of them have made quite a few people very wealthy.
Well, I think that you bring up some very important points, and the first is that the more you introduce school choice, the more children are lost, truly lost, because no one knows where they are. Usually when kids leave a charter because the charter closed or because the charter pushed them out, there's quite a lot of, I mean, the charters that have high scores also have very high attrition rates and high suspension rates. And by the way, the new Secretary of Education, John King, was a leader of a charter school called the Uncommon Schools Network in Massachusetts, which had the highest suspension rate in the state of Massachusetts. And that's not a way to educate children, by throwing them out of school. But and what's happened in New Orleans, which is now almost an all-charter district, is no one knows where the missing kids are. There are a lot of kids in New York, and sorry, not in New York, in New Orleans, that are not in school and that are school-age, and no one knows where they are because no one is responsible for keeping track of all the children. So they might be in a charter, they might leave the charter, and then no one, they just disappear and they're on the streets. And the same thing, I imagine, is happening in Milwaukee, where no one feels that they're responsible for tracking where are the children. Are they in school? Are they in a voucher school? Are they in a charter school? Are they in a public school? And no one knows because no one's in charge.
Hmm. Thank you very much, Clara, for your call. Diane Ravitch, thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I always love talking to you, Kathleen.
Yeah, thanks, Diane. We covered a lot of important issues this hour. She's the former assistant, U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, and is the author of several books, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, Reign of Error. She is a research professor of education at New York University and a historian of education. We thank her for being with us to cover A wide variety of topics. Tomorrow, during this hour, I told you Norman Lear will be with us, the creator of television programs All in the Family, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Mary Hartman. So he'll be with us the second hour of our program. And the first hour of the show, we'll take a look at how the Badger guns ruling here in Milwaukee could set a new legal precedent for gun shop owners all over the country. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee.